and I felt like I got my life back.
Quietus is real, my friend.
Quietus has changed my life.
Call right now for your risk-free trial of Quietus at 1-800-485-4617. That's 1-800-485-4617. Stop the ringing now. 1-800-485-4617. That's 1-800-485-4617.
Hey guys, I want to give you an opportunity that you've never had before. My name is Ellen, and I'm an attorney talking to you about a medical breakthrough for men in the sexual health world that uses cutting-edge technology. This amazing product is called Retoxor, and the results have been remarkable on the subjects who were studied during case testing. Legally, all I'm allowed to say on the radio is that the before and after comparisons are nothing short of shocking. Be one of the first 50 callers right now and find out how to get Retoxor for free. Due to the private nature of Retoxor, we have created an identity protection program, which absolutely guarantees you that nobody will ever know you participated. Your name will never appear in any delivery, and there will be no emails or phone calls. As a matter of fact, we won't even ask you for your name when you call.
Shocking before and afters. 800-434-4502. Your identity is completely protected. 800-434-4502. That's 800-434-4502 right now.
Dr. Schachner, please dial 234.
If you or someone you know has been left with lingering physical injuries because of a medical mistake, call Robert B. Sykes & Associates, 801-533-0222, because we don't let go.
Gung Ho increases memory storage and recall.
Gung Ho, when taken at suggested doses, will improve memory storage and recall. Gung Ho could be called a brain nutrient because it increases levels of several important neurotransmitters. Improve your memory. Go to k-talk.com and click on Gung Ho.
Eat like focus.
And now, Mormon Miscellaneous with Van Hale on K-Talk.
Good evening, this is Van Hale. I'm happy to be here tonight, and we're going to talk about Mormonism tonight. A little different topic than I've been addressing to recently. So, and in fact, tonight we're going to be talking about something that has to do with the Book of Mormon and something that has to do with the Americas, the ancient Americas. So I have a guest with me by phone today, and he's from California. He's from an area that I spent some time there, 1964. And so we're going to talk with Daniel Johnson. And he got interested in a topic, and he spent some time with us, and so we're going to talk tonight about what he's doing and a book that he's working on, and we're going to talk about typically what we refer to as Mesoamerica, and so I'm going to put him on the air right now, and we'll see what we're going to do today. I'm not sure what we're going to talk about, but that always happens, I think, on my programs. Oftentimes it doesn't matter what I start out with, we end up going down some path, or when we're going down a path, we end up going down another path or something. So we'll see what happens tonight. So let me go to my line, and Daniel, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, it looks like the phone's working and everything, so we're just going to move on here tonight, and so we'll see what happens. But obviously the best thing to do to start with is I've only met you on the internet a bit, and I've been on your blog, and but I don't know very much about you, so let's just talk about you for a minute. In fact, let's have you talk about it.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, right now I'm in California. I'm in Northern California, Sonoma County, actually. I did used to live in Utah for quite a while. So I lived in Utah. I'm actually from Florida originally. And a long time ago, my mother and I actually moved from Florida to Utah. And I've spent my teenage years there and also went to college there. I am an illustrator, so I majored in illustration, did that for quite a while. Now most of my work is actually done digitally, and I also teach a good bit about the type of stuff that I do here in California. So I guess one of the main reasons I'm here is that I've always had a great love and interest for ancient American cultures and places and people and things, and especially how they related to the Book of Mormon. I think I might have learned that from my mother. She's had a fascination with ancient American peoples, and so I was raised in all those types of things, studying about it, learning about it. And for me, the great fascination was how it might relate to the Book of Mormon and what traces could be left. So my first trip to Mexico, I guess besides just a little jaunt over the border to Tijuana, but first of all, I call a real trip to Mexico was with my wife in 1999, visiting the ruins that you can easily see in the Yucatan Peninsula. And I just was, you know, I'd always loved the area and the culture, but being there was just something that was really great. And that just got me started, you know, really looking into it. So I'm actually the principal author of a couple of books. The first one is called An LDS Guide to Mesoamerica. And right now the second one is being just finished up with my publisher, and we're in the proofing and process. And that is an LDS guide to the Yucatan. So those kind of grew out of experiences that I had traveling around in those areas, and especially preparing for them and researching the sites out. So that's something that I've had a great deal of interest in, and I've had an opportunity to speak a lot about this in firesides and presentations and just any time I can. I've also worked with the Book of Mormon Archaeological Forum and have spoken at their annual conferences that they have each year in Salt Lake City.
So, tell me a little bit about the book that you have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the first one, An LDS Guide to Mesoamerica, initially it was going to be two books, and they were the result of some trips I took with my co-authors, really good friends of mine from my ward here in California. It ended up right before it was going to press, and I did the design, the layout work for it, that they said it was too long. And so I ended up kind of cutting it in half and have one book about one trip. And that trip is to Guatemala, Mexico, and a little bit into Honduras, visiting sites in the area. So really what happened was after we got back from those visits, where we visited various sites and we had done a decent amount of research into where to go and what to look at. We gave some firesides in our stake, and a lot of people were very interested in the things we had to show. And people kept asking us after these firesides, are you writing a book about this? So finally, we kind of thought, well, why not? So what we really were trying to do was, while we were preparing for these trips, we thought, you know, it would be great if someone would write a book that would be a guide for the LDS tourist on where to go and what to look at each site and what might have some Book of Mormon connection, and just kind of put things in the overall context. And there are any number of guidebooks about traveling to Mexico and Guatemala and guides to the sites. And there are any number of books by some really good LDS authors and scholars about Book of Mormon connections and archaeology. But no one had ever actually written, apparently, sort of like a site-by-site guide. And that's what we ended up doing. We ended up writing the book that we were looking for as we were preparing for these trips.
When was the book published?
The our first one, An LDS Guide to Mesoamerica, it came out in 2008, and that was published by Cedar Fort. And so that's a hardbound copy, and it's really nice. It's full color, great pictures, and all sorts of info. And what we're working on right now, actually just finishing up, is an LDS Guide to the Yucatan that is also going to be published by Cedar Fort. This one is going to be an e-book, at least initially. And so that'll be available through Cedar Fort's website and also available for Kindle and Nook and things like that.
So when you're talking about, in your book, the LDS Guide to Mesoamerica, and you're, so I'm assuming then that the person that would be interested in the book would be probably somebody who's LDS, is that, or would somebody else use the book?
I would hope so. I mean, at appearances I've done where I've done talked to people and gone to and done book signings at bookstores, I've talked to people who are not LDS and tried to tell them, well, here's why the book is interesting, and there are fascinating things, I think, beyond just from an LDS point of view. I do have a friend of mine who was a good influence on me growing up, a seminary teacher, and kind of kept in contact with it. He said he felt the book was really good because it was a very kind of, you know, balanced approach, and that even people who, you know, weren't really that involved with the church could actually find use in its information. So it's kind of divided up into sections. So we have one section, you know, it's chapters, and then for each site there'll be a section where we talk about how we got there, what happens. There are some sort of misadventures that we had along the way. There'll be a main section which talks about just the archaeology of the site, its history, and what happened when it was occupied and how it fits into the overall history. And there'll be a section which is Book of Mormon comparisons. So here are things from that site, from its history, from its archaeology, from its artifacts that are similar to things you read in the Book of Mormon. And for the most part, I tried to use all non-LDS scholars, so the preeminent Mayan scholars, as my source material to try and keep hopefully as good and balanced information as I can.
So why is your focus on Mesoamerica?
That's a good question. I think it's because, you know, there are various competing theories about where Mormon events, you know, took place. So there are theories that kind of started initially back when Joseph Smith was still alive. There are comments he made that led people one direction or the other. And there are have kind of been ways that we as a church have looked at it since that time. But I think with much of that was out the benefit of archaeology, in modern archaeology. And so as more work is done in North America, in Central America, in South America, pretty much the majority of LDS scholars who really study this, this is their profession and their passion, they've all kind of centered on Mesoamerica as being really the best candidate in terms of population, in terms of cities and centers, in terms of written language and culture and what was going on, the time period, and also geographically, all kind of tends, I think, to point towards Mesoamerica, which would be primarily Guatemala, southern Mexico, some of the Yucatan Peninsula, maybe up to central Mexico. But you'll find, I think, it's kind of the weight of evidence or the weight of opinion of LDS scholars is leaning us that way now. There are always people who have a different opinion, and some actually widely different opinions, but the guys who are serious scholars, for the most part, are looking in that direction.
Yeah, there. I've just read into some of the different items that have been published for many, many years. Mm-hmm. When I was on my mission in Northern California, that was a real topic. I can't remember where I was at that time, but I was in Northern California. But there was a man who was giving a lecture, you know, at his fireside, and he was showing us. I remember it was just so interesting to me. He was just laying this out for us, so we knew exactly where the Book of Mormon took place, and it was he had brought together, I don't know, 100 passages or whatever, and so we were all kind of watching this, as he was explaining all of this. But when we walked out, my companion and I were there, and then just there were about 25 or 30 people there. But we were we left, and we were all saying, "Boy, that was we were really impressed. That was terrific. That was great." And then somebody said, "Well, what was he telling us about?" And none of us really knew mm-hmm. what he was showing. And it was, but that's fun. There have been so many people who have different points of view as to where the Book of Mormon took place, and there's this young man. Well, he passed away a few years ago, but he was publishing a pamphlet up here, and he was showing that the Book of Mormon had to have taken place in New York. And he had left the church, and he was approaching this to demonstrate that Joseph Smith had just he just came up with the Book of Mormon based upon the area around him, and so he was just using the geography at that area. So anyway, that was I talked to him a few times, and that was. It was really kind of interesting, but you're thinking that what's in my mind is I wonder what would happen if I were to ask the people in my ward, if I were to say where did the Book of Mormon take place, and I don't really know. I don't know what the people in my ward would say. I think that it would not be. I think the focus would not be on Mesoamerica, but I don't know.
Well, that's a good question, and part of why I wrote the book was to address sort of what I call the traditions that we have about the Book of Mormon as members of the church. It seems like even Joseph Smith's ideas or opinions about where it might have taken place had evolved. A lot of serious LDS scholars believe that he was really focusing on the areas of Mexico and Guatemala in the later years of his life, and that was really based on comments that were published while he was editor of Times and Seasons regarding some books that had just been published at that time, in the late, I think, 1839, 1841, about some travelers, Stevens and Catherwood, who traveled in those areas and reported back on what was there. And that was the first time, really, that people in the United States had heard anything about those places and knew what was there. So, like I say, if you follow the LDS scholars on this, you'll see really the weight of opinion turning to Mesoamerica, and almost everyone is convinced that it was not a huge area. It could not have been the entire Western Hemisphere. But there had to be an area limited by hundreds of miles, not thousands. And so I would say, you know, the majority consensus is Mesoamerica. When you think about Book of Mormon tours and trips, Joseph Allen and his tour company is one of the major ones that does that. They're going to Mexico and Guatemala, and pretty much all Book of Mormon tours are doing that. So there's just so much there that seems to parallel fairly closely what we have, and I can give any number of reasons that it's a good area for it. It's the most likely place, and I'm open for anything that suggests that it could be somewhere else, but I think at the moment what we understand really points us to those areas. They seem to really match up nicely. The geography matches up nicely, and for example, even though most LDS scholars are kind of pinned on Mesoamerica, they're is enough difference where some might say Zarahemla was here, some would say no, Zarahemla was there. And of course, a major feature in the Book of Mormon is the River Sidon. Well, there are two rivers, one that actually separates Mexico from Guatemala and one not far off actually in Mexico, that are very likely candidates for the River Sidon. And last year at the Book of Mormon Archaeological Forum's conference, they had this panel where people debated back and forth, is it one, is it the other? One river is called the Grijalva, one's called the Usumacinta. And so each group gave its points for why this was Sidon. No, here's why this is Sidon. It was interesting, but I'm not sure anyone knows for sure yet, but those are two very likely candidates. So that, you're right, there's I don't know if we know 100%. I think we're zeroing in on it, but there is still room for discussion and exploration and more ideas.
Well, a number of years ago, when I came home from my mission, I went to BYU, and I had decided to go into archaeology. So I started going to the class and everything, but, you know, I just didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided not to pursue that. But it was, I don't know if I could put if I could say this is what was going on, but shortly after I came home from my mission, within the next several years, there was some question about the Book of Mormon, because there was this idea of, let's look, I don't think anyone was calling it Mesoamerica, just talking about the isthmus, you know, that we're going down there and looking in that area, there was an article in the LDS Church News on back at that time, and what was being presented was that the Kimura was down there, it wasn't up in New York, and that was there were a lot of people that were talking about it back at that time, about this idea of there being the approach was there, maybe there were two different Kimuras, and so the original Kimura was down in Mesoamerica, and then the plates were brought up to New York, and so that wasn't really the real Kimura. This article it was just a little article in the Church News at that time, it was on the back page, but that was a strong statement in there against that idea of there being two different Kimuras. So, but now what? What would be the thinking on this?
That's a great question. I seem to recall perhaps an answer by President Joseph Fielding Smith against the two Kimura idea. But there are a couple of things I think things are accepted. One is that the Nephite final battle happened around a hill, and that it was in the same general vicinity as the Jaredites around their final battles. And the Jaredites had a name for the hill, the Nephites had a name for it, and the Nephites called it Kimura. Of course, Kimura is a word from the Book of Mormon. And we read several times about the plates being buried, but then they were taken up. I mean, Mormon had them buried for a while, and then they were taken up. And we know that Moroni traveled with them for quite a while. And during the times of his travels, he finished the writing, he translated the Book of Ether, and so the general sense is that the Hill Kimura mentioned in the Book of Mormon as the site of these major battles, that area is not New York. So I'm not sure that Joseph Smith himself ever really named that Hill Kimura. After the plates were taken out, it began to be called that, the one that's in New York where they were buried. But I think most LDS scholars today, I think now we have the benefit of so much more information in this area, especially with the terms of history and archaeology and anthropology and ancient study, much more so than in earlier eras. But I think most LDS scholars today would hold to the idea of this final battle and the location named Kimura in the Book of Mormon as taking place in Mesoamerica. And that after that, Moroni, as a righteous Nephite, would have to escape, and that he headed northward, and that he was able to travel from that area up to New York. And in fact, there are comments by, I believe, Brigham Young about Moroni dedicating future temple sites. And so if you kind of look at things like St. George, Manti, Salt Lake, Nauvoo, Kirtland, that might be kind of a clue as to, you know, paths that he could have dedicated along his way from Mesoamerica up to ending up in New York, where he would have had to physically bury the plates there for Joseph Smith to find them. So, I guess you could say a two Camorra theory is prevalent these days. If hopefully that doesn't shake anyone's world too much.
There's this question, and I haven't really gathered some material together on this, but I haven't really seen if we're going to the general authorities, we go back to conferences and talks and things like that over the years, it hasn't seemed to me that the general authorities have moved into the direction of Camorra being in Mesoamerica rather than in New York.
Well, again, the we know for certain that the hill where Moroni would have buried the plates and other objects was in New York. The question is, where did the events mentioned in the Book of Mormon take place? And when it comes to general authorities and any kind of official position, they don't have one. They really stay away from serious pronouncements about geography in the Book of Mormon. And I've even read some that suggest that it's not revealed to the Lord, and too much looking into it, you know, could cause problems. Yeah, so they stay completely away from it. So the idea of finding out where the Book of Mormon took place, I think, is just one where we're left on our own. I don't think that there has been any really revealed word that says, here's where it happened. It's something which is fascinating, and I kind of wish I knew more, but apparently it's not as important for us to know as the other truths which are in the Book of Mormon. So, you know, we're kind of left to our own devices to study it out. And as I say, at this point, the general consensus among LDS scholars who are archaeologists, who are ancient linguists, who have studied this area for all their lives, is that they're pointing towards Mesoamerica as being the location where most of these events took place. Uh-huh. And that's just with the best knowledge we have now. But, you know, there is no, you're not going to find any official position on it. I mean, after Joseph Smith, no one really made any serious statements about it. And, you know, the church for quite a while, as you say, general authorities, they've just kind of kept away from the issue.
Uh-huh. Well, we have a caller. Let's go to our caller.
Mm-hmm.
You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I'd just like to say that the Jaredites were on the east coast of America as we know it. That's where they have pretty well been established. So if they were there, then so would the others be there. And I also think that I've been to Uxmal, Chichen Itza in the 60s. Okay, I know the areas, and there's so many have been discovered now, and I know a lot more has been discovered, but I don't think that they were the Lehites from Lehi, because the way the American Indians from, say, Buffalo on down to, say, the mid part, they're rectangular shape. They have moats around them. They're built out of wood. And all the ones in Central and South America, everyone I've ever seen or even pictures, are all out of cement. And they're like a pyramid. They're the shape of a pyramid. Now, you look at the things that you find in China and the Orient, different places. We know that a lot of people came over to this country and settled there from China and say, Japan and the islands and different places. And they came up apparently not from the straits, the Bering Straits, but they came up around the Circle of Fire, and a lot of them sailed straight over. A few of them made it in canoes. And they're square, and they're cement, just as like everything in the Orient is. And everything the American Indian did was like King Solomon's, rectangular. That's where theirs came from, their knowledge came from. Comment, please.
Oh, sure. Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that a lot of this is speculation. I think a lot of things we don't know for sure. When you talk about things being made of cement, certainly when you talk about Chichen Itza and Uxmal, those were built by the Maya, and those were built far after the Book of Mormon, Book of Mormon period had closed. So there were other people there. But the Maya and other people before the Maya also built much out of wood. When you talk about defensive fortifications and moats and things, I have been to sites in Mexico that have pretty much exactly what is mentioned by Captain Moroni as the defensive fortifications he built around his city. I've been to those there. And I can also tell you that pretty much any LDS scholar who is an archaeologist or who has really studied these areas would put the Jaredite area in kind of around the Gulf of Mexico, in that area of Mexico, and many of them kind of associate the Jaredites with the Olmec culture, which is kind of the ancient mother culture of Mexico.
Yeah, I've been
so
into Olmec.
That's the current thinking at the moment.
Well, you do have the DNA to the Book of Mormon, and that shows that they're up in the Americas. It doesn't show they're in South America at all. I can't think of the guy's name. Started with an M. Man, it was done a couple of years ago, the DNA of the Book of Mormon people.
Mm-hmm.
He's from Minden, Utah originally, and he lives down in Orem, I think, now. And I bought his little thing, and I liked his better than any I've seen. Don't forget, Joseph Smith was already dead when they started saying in that, what's it, Times and the Seasons, when they started speculating that it was in Central and South America.
Well, that's actually not correct.
I heard you say that, but I've read otherwise.
Well, I know a number of scholars who have talked about that, and so those things about that were published in the Times and Seasons, mm-hmm. talking about Stevenson Catherwood's travels, were actually published while he was editor and while he was still alive, and you can look at the dates there. Now, some of the some of the controversy is people that don't pick Mesoamerica. A big one now is what's called the Heartlanders around the Great Lakes area. They're kind of, there's a group focused on that. They're saying Joseph Smith was alive, but that he was in hiding and couldn't have been the editor at the time. No one I've heard is saying that he was dead. But there's a lot of speculation. The DNA thing is a fascinating question. DNA has been used by our opponents to say the Book of Mormon is not true at all. But I've heard DNA experts talk about this. And the real question is, was Lehi's party a minority in the overall areas, or was it otherwise? And the current thinking, again, when we were talking LDS scholars who are archaeologists and anthropologists, is that there are already people here, and that if Lehi's party was a minority, they may not have really left much of a DNA signature to be found. So that's one idea. You know, the great thing is that
I think they kept together, according to the Book of Mormon. It didn't sound like it spread all over the place.
Exactly, but I'm saying that we know there were people already here. And so the Nephites were a minority.
You talking about the Olmecs? Weren't they killed up by then?
Who's that?
The Olmecs. That's the only one I can think of. Who's here? Who was here?
Well, lots of people. I mean, there are people on the coast of Guatemala from 1500 B.C. on down. There have been all kinds of people. There were the Maya. Mm-hmm. There were the people before the Maya.
Well, there's a lot of Chinese influence, the square, the pyramid, the cement, and that's Chinese in the Orient. That is not.
You know, it certainly could be. I've seen... The fascinating thing is this, that the idea that we have, groups of people, you know, we have at least three different ones that we know from the Book of Mormon. Lehi's group, the people of Zarahemla, and the Jaredites coming from the Old World to the New. Scientifically speaking, that hasn't been very acceptable for a long time. In
but
the
that
past
was way
few
before
years,
their time. That was the time of the flood, wasn't it? I don't mean the flood. That was the time
of
the tower. The tower.
Yeah, well,
the
Jaredites would have been in Tower of Babel. My
Tower
whole point
Babel,
is that... The whole point is that for a long time, that hasn't been acceptable to say scientifically. You know, people, Native Americans came across the Bering Strait on down, that was it. However, there's been a lot of acceptance now in the past couple of years about the idea that there are many people that came to the Americas. So there's a Chinese influence. Some people suggest a Japanese influence in Central America. Some people have even, you know, started re-looking at the idea of what the Book of Mormon says. And there are other stories about people from the Old World coming to the New. So that's been more seriously considered these days than it has in the past. I think
don't
that's a great
move. After the Times and Seasons set their eyes on Central and South America, then so much was invested in our church literature and excursions there and everything else. They didn't want to change their mind in the middle of a stream, I don't think. A lot of that was the archaeologists would just center on that. That's just my opinion.
That's possible. There may be some of that, you know. We don't know for sure. I can tell you that I've done a lot of looking into this. I've talked to a lot of the authors and the guys who know a lot more than I do. And Mesoamerica is the place that they've settled on. And so when you look at population numbers, when you look at the cities, when you look at the kind of culture that was there, they're finding a lot of things that compare favorably. I think, you know, we might find a little bit everywhere that there could be things that are similar.
Where do you think the Savior appeared to the Nephites? Where do you think that was?
Where do I think? I'm not sure how much my opinion means, but what I'm saying is that pretty much all serious LDS scholars have picked Mesoamerica. So I would pick somewhere in the Mexico-Guatemala area. That the events mentioned in the Book of Mormon, I would say for now, I would go with the fact that they happened in that area.
May I ask one more question, and then I'll just...
Oh, sure.
Hang on there. Just one second there. Now, I understand that just in the last 20 years, whatever, they have discovered that, maybe 20, I got mixed up, but 20 miles south of Chichen Itza Uxmal, they have this whole vast city that has been buried, and sunk, I guess, buried from the earthquakes and that. It's bigger than anything we've ever discovered. Have they done any more on that now? Because that is huge, and it could be clear to the coast.
I don't know about the city buried by earthquakes. In that area, you have an ancient site called El Mirador, which was an ancient pre-classic site, so it dates to Book of Mormon times and before. And it was one of the largest sites ever.
Yeah, and that's just recent. They've discovered that, 20 miles south of the Mayan ruins, right?
That's still the Maya area. I mean, the Mayan area would be the Yucatan Peninsula and all the way down all of Guatemala and southern Mexico and a bit of Honduras. So
is south of Uxmal Chichen Itza. Isn't that the one that's the biggest one they've ever discovered?
The largest ones I know of are in kind of northern Guatemala, and so there would be El Mirador, as I mentioned.
Okay.
Another one is just over the border in southern Yucatan called Calakmul, and we have a chapter about that in our upcoming book.
Yeah,
and another one would be a major one in Guatemala called Tikal. Those were some of the largest cities ever.
Yeah. And that's west, and that's wild. And that I think is definitely from the Orient. That picture I see on that. But anyway,
I don't know of anyone that would agree with that, but, you know, there's always opinions to check around.
Well, I'm kind of dumb about that, but I can pick up on what I've been there and seen and then the pictures I see and what I've read. But I think it's a very, no matter, it's an interesting study because the world is certainly different than we really always know it. We think we know it is. And
I agree with that. Yes, I do agree with that.
Anyway, the Book of Mormon, I definitely think is the most revealing thing that we've ever had. Since Jesus Christ was crucified, and it's so wonderful that it has been restored in the last days. And I will testify to that. I definitely have my grandfather came in the last handcart company, left England, and I guess most of the Ephraim people from the following, or from the tribe of Ephraim, were from the England and Wales and Ireland, Scotland, etc. And and they've come here, and it's certainly a testament to what they have built, and because of the restored gospel in the last days, and they couldn't have done it without it being restored, because the world has certainly lost most of the truths of Christianity. You know, they can't even agree on anything. So, anyway, that's my two cents for the day, and I appreciate the time. And thank you very much.
I appreciate your calling in and being able to talk with you. And I do agree with that. I mean, I've been the gospel doctrine teacher in my ward for many years, and as we're teaching the Book of Mormon this year, I'm just remembering that again and again, seeing just how powerful it is and how its teachings are just inspired. And that's really,
you know,
I think, what we can all agree on.
One thing, too, I just have been reading Marvelous Work and a Wonder, LeGrand Richards, and he was so, that was such a promoting thing for all the missionaries for years and years and years. And I keep rereading that every once in a while. And I really love that book, you know, to tie things in for the gospel in the last days, restoration of Jesus Christ's gospel. And that's
I believe whenever my mother was investigating the church, that book was one thing that had a profound effect on her.
Oh, yes, many, many. And I appreciate your efforts, and I thank you so much for the time.
Right, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to another caller. Let me just mention this. If you would like to give us a call, if you want to ask a question or make a comment, the number here is 254, that's 801-254-5855. 801-254-5855. Okay. Uh-oh. I lost Daniel. Let me see what... I wonder what happened here. Okay, I just need to pause here for a second. I don't know what's happened on this. Just take this call, see what happens. Okay, I've just, I don't know what happened to my phone line here. Let me just pause here for a minute and see what I can do here.
Obviously, the VFW gives me a first class ticket, so you know Don well, she's going to get one, or she'd take mine, and I end up in the cheap seats. So.
Hey, Richard, you know, in your travels in the past year, did you ever run into anybody around the world that didn't quite understand the VFW's mission or questioned the VFW's commitment? Or what was the overall response?
Well, the overall response that I got is, I don't know, for example, you're sitting with a deputy minister of defense in China or the president of Taiwan, President Ma, and or the some of the other influential people in those countries. They may not really know what we do completely,
right?
But I always had the feeling that they respected us. I had that feeling the minute you walked in the door and sat down with them. I never got the feeling that they were just brushing us off and just paying us a courtesy, not to to embarrass their country or something. I always felt that they respected us and that they were willing to talk with us and. They took the issues that we brought to the table seriously. I never had a feeling that there was a lack of respect or anything like that.
Well, I would say just given the fact that you were given audience with these world leaders, speaks volumes about the stature of the organization.
Yep.
I don't know how many posts you visited. You probably don't either.
No, I couldn't even keep track. you'd go into a department and they'd take you to, some of them would take you Some of them had a like in California, we went from one end of the state to the other.
Yeah,
and then ended up in Reno at the Nisei reunion. Ohio took me around to almost all, I would gather, most of the posts in their, it felt like most of the posts in their department.
And when we were in Texas, it seemed like we covered a lot of miles in Texas.
Yes, we did. Yep.
Out of all those posts you visited, any very, very special moments, poignant moments, stick out in your memory?
Well, you mentioned Texas, and we went out to one of the posts that did an awful lot of work and support for those people that lost their homes and all of their belongings to that forest fire that they had. And I was very impressed with the people in that post, and not only what the department did, but what the districts and the post did in supporting those people and helping those people go through a very, very traumatic time. And that certainly stands out. You always go to a department and maybe go to one or maybe two posts that really kind of stand out with the work that they do and the type of quarters that they have. And you can see that they're a working post, and there's an awful lot of people in there that are volunteering the time. You certainly never, there's never a loss of finding a post like that in at least one or two posts in a department when you visit them. But certainly that post in Texas, I don't know if you, I think you might have been with us, Jerry,
yes,
on that.
Yes, yeah, I was, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I want to say this, and I'll be seeing you again, in fact, probably this weekend.
Yes, you will.
And I'll have opportunity to see you again over the years, but I just wanted to go on record while I can to let you know what a privilege it was to serve with you, what an honor it is to know you, and how much I value our friendship.
Well, same here, Jerry.
Yeah.
And also you too, Randy.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Richard. I certainly go to sentiments, and it's just been a pleasure to watch you work, and great job.
I loved what I was doing.
You could tell.
When you love what you do,
yep.
you generally do pretty good.
Yep.
You know?
Hey, Richard, thanks for your time on the program,
too. Thank you very much. And I don't know if I'll see you this weekend, Randy, but I know I'll see Ricky Lee.
I've been given a memo by Jerry that I'm not allowed to see you ever again. So,
all right, guys.
And I love to Teresa.
Absolutely. I'll pass that along. And the same to you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. We'll be right back here on the National Defense.
Saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for a place called Lee Ho Fooks. Wanted to get a big dish of chow mein. Bite down!
At some auto shops, it can feel like you're dealing with a bunch of who are just out to get you. But not every auto shop sees its customers like it. Right now at Sears Auto Center, save on a brake service which includes replacement of pads or shoes plus reconditioning of rotors. And help your vehicle recover from the harsh heat of summer with $10 off an AC recharger coolant exchange. This is service you can trust. This is Sears Auto Center. For these coupons and more, stop by or visit searsauto.com. Valid for most vehicles. Offers end 8/25. Shop fees and exclusions apply. See store for details.
Baa baa black sheep, have you any wool? No, sir, no, sir. Some nincompoop with pantyhose pulled over his face stole all my wool sweaters and gaming system. Luckily, the Geico Insurance Agency recently helped me with renter's insurance. Everything stolen was replaced, and the little boy who lives down the lane was caught trying to sell it online. Call Geico and see how easy it is to switch and save on renter's insurance.
When your child was a baby, you were careful to provide the right nutrition for a growing mind.
I'm going to school now, Mom.
Don't forget your lunch.
Even though your child is older now, it's still important to support their brain development. That's why every mom should know about Children's Omegables, the supplement with essential omega-3 fish oil to support healthy brain function in your child. Science shows us that omega-3 fish oil is vital to your child's developing mind.
15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Call 1-800-947-AUTO
or visit.
I don't know. I'm just dealing with some problems here, but let's go back to Daniel here and let's see what happens. You there, Daniel? Are you there? You there?
I can.
There you are.
I can hear you.
Okay. All right. Let's go to this other caller and let's see what happens. I don't know. Our phone line's different today. They've done something to it. I don't know if I'm doing this the right thing or not. But let's just try this again and see what happens. I just lost that caller. Well, let me invite that caller to call back. I don't know. I didn't bring a hammer with me. I could fix this if I had a hammer here. Okay, what were we talking about when I lost you? We were talking about that caller. So yes, there. Well, what do you think's happening in the church about the questions about the Book of Mormon? It seems to me like we're not dealing with this in our gospel doctrine class or something like that when it's the last couple of times, you know, it comes up about every 4 years or so. But I don't think we're addressing that. These kinds of questions in our gospel doctrine class. You there, Daniel? I don't know. You're on the air.
Yes. Well, I guess malfunction at the junction. The reason I called was... my observation about many religious people, I'm probably an agnostic, but it seems to me the beauty of religion that it's based on belief and faith without the need for some kind of scientific proof or that there's absolute... certain documentation, and not to denigrate, our theological studies or that. For instance, as an example, the Shroud of Turin has been proved scientifically not to be what it's described to be, but millions of people have faith that it is, and I just kind of sometimes question the need for proof about the tenets of different religions, and that in and of themselves that should be sufficient without a need to somehow tie it to some kind of scientific documentation.
Well, that's I like what you've said. That's a good question. Just the experience that I've had in Mormonism throughout all the years, also numerous conversations that I've had with people who are non-LDS Christians, there are just a lot of different ideas. Now, there are a number of people that I've talked to that they believe in God and they believe in their religion based upon having the Bible. They're saying, well, I'm certain about God because I've read about this in the Bible. There would be a number of other people who would say, well, I don't, that's not the way I'm approaching this. About my belief. And so there would be talking about something like this, that I have had an experience something like an inspiration or something from God, that approach. And then their beliefs are based upon something like that. Or then you have people whose belief are not based upon something like that. It's just based upon the fact of having an experience, going through their life, and they're living their life a certain way, and they think that this is part of what Jesus was teaching, and so forth. And so they're committed into Christianity based upon the teachings of Jesus. But then you have people who have a lot of questions about something. Like you turn to the Bible and the question would be, well, what about Genesis? And of course that's something that's been a topic.
And isn't that sort of a crisis of faith then?
Well, for a number of people, I would say yes. There are a number of people who would say, well, no, the Bible is, we know how the earth was created, but if the scientific community has brought so many material, so many facts and things together, and they're saying the earth is much older than if you're relying upon Genesis, there are a number of people who would say, well, no, the science approaches on this, they have to be wrong, or if they're right, then the Bible's wrong, and if the Bible's wrong, then we don't have, there is no God. And so there are these kinds of ideas that are being kicked around all the time from different people. But
I imagine it would be wonderful if the two could coincide precisely and everybody'd be satisfied. But to get back to my original statement and just my comment, to me, the beauty of religion is an individual's.
I've got to just cut you in right here because we're going to news.
That's fine. But
thank you. I appreciated your call. Thank you.
All right. Sure.
NBC News Radio, I'm Melissa Rayberger. Gulf Coast states are preparing for Isaac, a tropical storm that could become a hurricane tonight. NBC weatherman Al Roker is in Tampa.
Tropical storm Isaac gained strength today, passing through the warm waters of the Florida Straits before slamming the Keys with intense wind and heavy rain. Thousands in Florida are already without power. Hundreds of flights have been canceled, and mandatory evacuations are underway in some coastal towns.
Florida Governor Rick Scott says because of the western track of Isaac, Florida will be ready to assist other states that get a bigger hit from the tropical storm. Isaac's shift to the west could mean Tampa, Florida will be spared the worst of the storm. It could also mean that New Orleans, which was hit 7 years ago by Hurricane Katrina, could get slammed again. Katrina was the costliest natural disaster in history and among the deadliest of storms. The GOP is reconfiguring its Tampa convention by cramming 4 days of events into a storm-shortened 3 days. This is NBC News Radio. Republican presidential contender Mitt Romney says his ego is not what makes him run.
This is not an ego ride for me. I'm really concerned about America. And I think this president is weakening America in very fundamental ways, and a lot of people are suffering for it now.
President Obama has taken the weekend off from the campaign, but will resume travel tomorrow. Gunmen using silencers have shot and killed 8 police and soldiers in Iraq today. 3 of the victims were security guards at a Baghdad amusement park. More than 200 people have been killed in such attacks in Iraq this month. Israeli police have arrested 3 Jewish youths from a West Bank settlement in connection with a firebomb attack that wounded 6 Palestinians in a taxi. The suspects are minors, ages 12 to 13. At the box office, Expendables 2 has sold the most tickets for the second week in a row. The film stars Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and other 1980s tough guys. The Bourne Legacy came in second, Paranorman third. I'm Melissa Rayberger, NBC News Radio.
There are few things in life as debilitating as a severe headache, whether it's caused from stress, anxiety, depression, or too much to drink. There is a remedy. How would you like to get rid of a headache before it happens? Migralex is the answer. Migralex will not only get rid of your headache, it will help prevent headaches from the start.
I'm Dr. Mauskop. I have been studying headaches as a neurologist for 25 years, and I know the effects they can have on the person. I have developed Migralex to free people from the pain and keep them from getting headaches.
Migralex works so fast, I almost forgot I even had a headache.
I never thought anything could save me from getting bad headaches. With Migralex, I'm headache free.
I know Migralex will free you from headache pain, and I guarantee it.
Call 800-507-6836 to learn how you can get a free bottle and see how it can work for you. That's 800-507-6836. Stop suffering with headaches today. Act now. Call 800-507-6836 or go to Migralex.com. That's Migralex.com.
Quietus contains homeopathic ingredients traditionally used to provide relief.
Can you hear that sound? That ringing, that hissing.
I can't get to sleep with it.
I can't concentrate. I hear it constantly. Everywhere I go, it doesn't go away. It drives me nuts.
It's tinnitus.
A constant ringing in your ear caused by loud machines.
Loud music.
Ah, finally. Quietus.
I love Quietus.
I couldn't believe it. No more ringing in the ears. No more hissing sound. Quiet relief so I can work.
No more ringing. No more loud fans.
And I sleep like a baby.
If you're suffering from tinnitus, I urge you to try Quietus.
After trying Quietus, the ringing stopped and I felt like I got my life back.
Quietus is real, my friend.
Quietus has changed my life.
Call right now for your risk-free trial of Quietus at 1-800-485-4617. That's 1-800-485-4617. Stop the ringing now. 1-800-485-4617. That's 1-800-485-4617.
Hey, this is Jake the Computer Guy from PC Laptops. It's back to school time and normally I'm all bummed out because summer rules. But not this year because I got a brand new PC Laptops Titan computer featuring the Intel Core i7 processor. You know, a lot of companies build crappy computers. These companies beat the snot out of you trying to sell you some rip-off extended warranty. If any store ever tries to sell you a rip-off extended warranty, just say, "Don't rip me off," and go straight to PC Laptops. All new PC Laptops desktop computers come with a lifetime service and parts warranty. Nobody else does that. That means if your hard drive blows up in 10 years, you're covered at 100%. And to make it extra fluffy, we're doing zero down, zero interest for a whole year on any new PC Laptops computer. OAC. Plus, if you have a student our faculty ID will give you an extra $100 off any new computer. Call us at 1-877-596-SAVE or check us out at PCLaptops.com. That's PCLaptops.com. Because at PC Laptops, we love you.
If you have not filed taxes for any year when you had income, then call me, Jim Kirkwood, at 801-915-9927. If you have a letter from the IRS or State Tax Commission, then call me, Jim Kirkwood, at 801-915-9927. If you're being called in for an audit, then call me, Jim Kirkwood, and let me consult with you on the tax law and specific tax returns in question. Taxes are going way up, and the IRS has hired thousands of new agents, so let me help you legally pay the minimum possible. Be prepared and call me, Jim Kirkwood, because the IRS licenses me, and I pass special IRS tests that only 1% of tax preparers have even taken. Call me at 801-915-9927. That's 801-915-9927. Let me suggest possible deductions and tax strategies. I'm a small business specialist, and I want to help you survive the ever-increasing tax burden and nightmare. That's 801-915-9927.
And now, Mormon Miscellaneous with Van Hale on K-Talk.
All right, I'm back for the second hour, and we'll see what happens. I've been playing around with this phone during the news, and let's see if this is going to work all right. But I think you're there, right, Daniel?
I am, and I actually wanted to comment a little bit on what that last caller said.
Yes, that would be good. Go ahead.
Well, it's interesting. He called up and identified himself as an agnostic. And also said he felt the beauty of religion was that it was, you know, faith and belief and not, I guess, more scientific proof. And that, I think, is a fascinating statement. I know some people that would call that the weakness of religion, But I think there is a beauty in that, and that the Book of Mormon itself says that we must first believe, we must use faith, and that's how you really come to any great appreciation of it. I think the things that I'm talking about, looking into the archaeology of it, finding some support that way, if you don't believe the Book of Mormon, it's not going to make much of a difference. I think for those of us that do believe, it may strengthen a testimony, but I think it also gives us a greater understanding into it than we might not otherwise have. But, yeah, it really does all go down to faith and belief. That seems to be what God wants us to start with there.
Well, of course, things are different than they are now. Right now, what we're seeing different ideas, a number of different ideas among Latter-day Saints in all different areas. The Book of Mormon is certainly an area there are a lot of ideas and thoughts about that. We go back to the time of Joseph Smith. Certainly there was no idea that we can find back at the time of Joseph Smith where they were thinking about the Book of Mormon people were in Mesoamerica. People were thinking at that time is that the Book of Mormon people were in North America, and you know, just but now, as what you've been mentioning, is that there are a number of Latter-day Saints who have spent a lot of time and effort into this area from their background and they're looking into this idea of Mesoamerica. But then we have the other situation of non-Latter-day Saints who I just don't know where there are a number of non-Latter-day Saints who are looking at the Book of Mormon and saying, well, yes, we found the evidence for the Book of Mormon in our studies of science. And
that's very true, and I think the main thing is that people who are not of our faith, non-LDS, don't really give the Book of Mormon a whole lot of thought, don't think. I mean, if the Book of Mormon is the Word of God, that's some pretty heavy, you know, connotation there. So I don't know that they really give it the amount of thought that we have, and so it would take people who actually believe in it to want to dedicate their study to finding out more about it. I'm just not sure that someone who is non-LDS is really going to, you know, be that bothered with the question so much.
Sure. And so that's a question that we're looking at. I know a number of Latter-day Saints who are interested in this question. There are a number that I've known who have left the church because they don't think that there's support from science in regards to the Book of Mormon. Mm-hmm. And then there are many, many Latter-day Saints who have faith based upon a lot of the research that's been done, and a number of Latter-day Saints who have written articles and books and who have talked about this. And then there are, I would say, a large number of people in my ward. Just, they're not really interested in questions about the historicity of the Book of Mormon. They're really not interested in that. They read the Book of Mormon, they study it, it's a very valuable book for them, and they don't, whatever people are talking about on this, they don't pay any attention.
That's okay, because, you know, the Book of Mormon is not something really written to give us an insight into the ancient historical world, or to tell us about what happened, you know, at a certain spot or anything like that. It's written for us to tell us, here is God's direction for you today. Here are things you need to know today. And that, you know, the doctrine in there, the guidance that it gives us, that's what it's all about. There's no doubt about it. You know, and if you don't want to take it any further than that, that's fine. You'll be, you know, your life will be greatly enriched by it. For those that, you know, wonder more than that, these are interesting questions or things that I've always wondered about myself. And I think as we look into this, we may gain a greater understanding as to how the Book of Mormon happened and what things were like, and we just, you know, may understand why certain things happened in there. I think that for example, the Book of Mormon itself leaves a lot of holes, a lot of questions unanswered. It's kind of vague in some spots. And we sort of filled in those holes with our own imaginings. One perfect example would be Arnold Freeberg's paintings. His, you know, paintings, yes, of, you know, Captain Moroni and the Standard of Liberty, or Helaman on his white charger with the stripling warriors, or, you know, Abinadi before King Noah. These have kind of become our understanding of the Book of Mormon. Well, those are paintings, and they're not necessarily based on any true facts. As we understand more about the ancient cultures, more of the history and the archaeology, then I think we'll gain a greater understanding of what really happened. We may have to sort of leave behind some of the traditions that we invented up to fill these blank areas. But I think if it gives us a greater understanding of who these people really were and how things happened, I think that's helpful. You can have a testimony of the Book of Mormon without it, but for those of us that, you know, are wondering about this, I think it, you know, it will give us a greater amount of understanding, and, you know, maybe we'll figure some things out about it we hadn't known before.
Mm-hmm. I've really enjoyed this statement from President Hinckley back in 2004, and this is in his address in the February Ensign, and he's talking about a number of things, but let me give this statement from President Hinckley. I think it's I like this statement. He says the evidence for its truth, for its validity, in a world that is prone to demand evidence, lies not in archaeology or anthropology, though these may be helpful to some. It lies not in word research or historical analysis, though these may be confirmatory. The evidence for its truth and validity lies within the covers of the book itself. The test of its truth lies in reading it. It is a book of God. Reasonable people may sincerely question its origin, but those who have read it prayerfully have come to know by power beyond the natural senses that it is true, and that it contains the Word of God, that it outlines saving truths of the everlasting gospel, that it, quote, came forth by the gift and power of God to the convincing of the Jew and Gentile that Jesus is the Christ. So that's I like that statement, because we do have a number of different ideas among Latter-day Saints. And so his position here is that there are different ways to look at this, but what he's coming down, what he's doing here, is that he's saying let me just go back to that one phrase there. He says, reasonable people may sincerely question its origin, but those who have read it prayerfully have come to know by a power beyond their natural senses. And so I know that there are a number of Latter-day Saints or a number of ex-Mormons and so forth who are stepping forward and saying, this is it. This is the fact right here. It's either we can prove that it came from God, or we can prove that it didn't come from God, and then there are these debates and all kinds of strange arguments and things in all different areas. But I think we are going to see for a long time, I think throughout my lifetime, which isn't very long, but I'll bet for the next 50 or 100 years, there will be many Latter-day Saints who believe in the Book of Mormon for one reason, someone else for a different reason, what their belief is based upon. But I am interested to see what, you know, what would happen down the road.
Yeah, it's always interesting, and I'm familiar with that quote from President Hinckley. It is a great quote, and I would tend to agree that you know, these things that I like to talk about that are in my books and that I share may be helpful, and they are fascinating, and they can add to our understanding and appreciation of it. But that's not where the truth comes from.
Yes,
these things are not going to convince anyone in and of themselves. It does take faith. It is a spiritual witness. That's where the real truth comes from. So I think these types of things with archaeology, with ancient history, with cultures, you find things that match up. They help us, you know, who already have that position. And I think they help us to really see and have a clearer idea of what went on. But yeah, they're no substitute for that true testimony. The Book of Mormon itself says, you know, here's how you figure it out. It doesn't say study archaeology and use that.
Well, and we have the same, we have a kind of a similar situation when we go to the New Testament and we're talking about Jesus, that Jesus was, he was crucified and he was resurrected. And how would we start to prove something like that?
You know, that's a great idea. That is pure faith. And that other caller that talked about the Shroud of Turin, you know, being proved that it's not what it was supposed to be, there are actually people that have good explanations for why that's not the case. If the Shroud of Turin, I mean, I don't see any reason that it would have to be Jesus' burial shroud. I don't see that we understand exactly what happens when a body is resurrected. But if it has no connection with Jesus at all, that doesn't affect our belief in his resurrection and what that means for each of us personally.
Mm-hmm. And there are many people, I don't know how many, but it would be quite a few, who would say, well, we know that Jesus was resurrected because we have the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And see, there were witnesses. They saw him, and it's written down.
But then a lot of people don't believe that.
Yeah.
You know, they'll say, well, everyone else has their book, and it says something different. So it's kind of, you know, what does the Spirit, you know, tell you when it touches you? I think that's really what it's all about. But the witnesses are important, you know.
Yes.
They are a type of evidence, just as, you know, the witnesses within the Book of Mormon itself are a type of evidence, and the, you know, studies from archaeology are a type of evidence. I think it can all fit together somehow.
All right, let's go to another caller. You're on the air.
Hello, this is Art in Baja, and I have a point of view that needs to be expressed, I think. I would say that the error that your host falls into is putting too much credibility with theistic Darwinism. He's, you know, he believes in God, but yet he believes in science. And really, when people say science, that's a code word for Darwinism, really. And if people are acquainted with the spirit, the language, the Book of Mormon makes it plain that the land northward is North America. The narrow neck of land is Central America, and the land southward is South America. And the Michigan tablet stones, which were assassinated by the Detroit press at the turn of the century, and James Talmadge came out against it as well, being a geologist, because there were saw marks on the slate. But the Book of Mormon talks about a progressive civilization that existed before Columbus, before the American Indian, rather. And this progressive civilization had the ability to saw slate. And the Egyptians sawed granite, and you can find saw marks on their granite from a machine like on the Nile. And so Talmadge drew an incorrect conclusion about these Michigan tablets, but the Book of Mormon talks about a exploring party that went to the land northward, and they found buildings and bones of animals among a land of many waters, it says in the Book of Mormon. Well, if you go to the Great Lakes, you find that the lakes are thousands of lakes, many waters. And the Upper Peninsula of Michigan is where these open-pit copper mines were located, which they've done carbon dating on, and found the date goes back to the Tower of Babel in the carbon. And so the perspective going from archaeology, and I've had my run-ins with archaeologists at the university. I handed out literature because I've done a mathematical probability study showing evolution is impossible using Carl Sagan's figures out of a book he wrote called Cosmos. And these archaeologists became furious. I mean, it was their religion I was attacking. And they don't have any objectivity at all. So I would just urge the people to believe and ask God if these things are not true, and then rely on the Spirit, because Joseph Smith said, whatever the world may think of this principle, that without revelation, they can know nothing of God or of the devil. Well, thank you very much for letting me speak.
Thank you.
Certainly, and my purpose here is not really to discuss evolution and Darwinism. I'd like to stick to things that are more closely aligned with the topic. The caller did mention a couple of things very specifically as though they were fact, and I think that's a bit of a mistake. He says very plainly the Book of Mormon says the land northward is North America, the land southward is South America. I don't know that it's that plain. I also know that, you know, the top LDS scholars in this area would disagree, and that the idea is that the Book of Mormon history, as it records, refers to a much smaller area of land than the entire Western Hemisphere. So there are a lot of questions that we don't know, and we're just kind of trying to figure out using our own devices. But I'm trying to go with, you know, the general consensus of this, what the scholarship today is saying. And the stuff in the Great Lakes is fascinating. The copper mines there I've read about. I don't know who was there. I do know that there were lots of people in these lands besides the people the Book of Mormon mentions. So I think there's a lot of history that we just don't know about. We just kind of studied recently that we're told not even a hundredth part of the people that went northward can be recorded in the Book of Mormon. So there's a lot we still have yet to find. We're dealing with just a very small bit that has come to us.
Okay, let's go to another caller. You're on the air.
Hello, Dan. And what's your guest name?
Daniel.
Daniel?
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
You've written a book?
Yes.
What's the name of the book?
Well, the book is called An LDS Guide to Mesoamerica. It's been out for a few years now. And just coming out, should be next month, will be An LDS Guide to the Yucatan. So these are, it's a site-by-site guide for LDS tourists who want to visit these sites and see exactly what's there and how to get there and how it might relate to Book of Mormon history. Or even if you never are able to go there yourself, this, I think, is kind of the next best thing. And so I love talking about them and love talking about the experiences I've had that led up to the books.
I'm Mills Crenshaw's producer, and I'd like to get you on his show, too.
I'd love that as well.
And maybe I could get your contact information through Van. And mm-hmm. But anyways, I'd like to explore with you some of the things that the way I approach the Book of Mormon is I consider what the text says, and then I do research to find out if there's any sources, artifacts or whatever that would suggest the possibility of a connection. Like, for example, one of the things that we should keep in mind, I think, is what it says in 2 Nephi chapter 1, verse 5, suggests that there's been many nations that could have possibly made it here. It says, yea, the Lord hath covenanted this land unto me and to my children forever, and also all those who should be led out of other countries by the hand of the Lord. So that
yes,
just all kinds of other possibilities of other people making it to the Antarctic. Would you agree?
That's very true. And the great thing is that I think science is much more open to that type of possibility now than in past years. And so I think that's a great thing.
In fact, it seems like there's a lot of artifacts that have been found from the Asian area, from you had like the Bat's Creek stone that was discovered, suggesting a Israel influence, and, mm-hmm. and other artifacts from different cultures from around the world, carvings that look like they're from Africa or Asia or Egyptian type of artifacts. So some of the things that would suggest that at least that passage is
true, and then you have the Egyptian mummies that have traces of cocaine and tobacco in them. That's really throwing people into a stir.
Now, there's another passage in the scriptures in the Book of Mormon that is real interesting to consider with the Mayan calendar round system, and that is the seven manic grasping hand symbol. Are you familiar with that one?
A bit, yes.
It's a bar with two dots, for seven,
that's how it
around, goes around in the circle. It matches up with what looks like a grasping hand symbol called manic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's real interesting is it in 3rd Nephi, chapter 8, verse 5, it talks about the 34th year and the first month of the fourth day, and then it gets into, so this is the fourth day of a new year. 34th year, and then there's 3 days of darkness, and seven manic matches up with that, with the traditions like the works of Histolito Shishito and other traditions about the great destruction that came before the fairy god appeared and promised to return. And so I find that for myself, as personally, as a corroborating evidence for that particular passage.
Yeah, there's some fascinating stuff, and in our new book that's just coming out, An LDS Guide to the Yucatan, I've got a chapter about the Mayan calendar, kind of explaining how it works and what's happening in 2012, and then correlate some of that to, is there any hint of that in the Book of Mormon? And so that's, there's some fascinating little insights here and there that are in our upcoming book. So, yeah, that's a great place for study.
Have you done anything in the corn god, the maize god, being resurrected by the headband twins?
And that's a fascinating one, too, the resurrection of the maize god that you see all over. I mean, there is the symbolism of that in the ball game, in the ball court at Chichen Itza especially. And of course, he went down to the underworld, was resurrected, by the hero twins. But you have this idea of conquering death. And what's interesting is that his resurrection created the tree of life. So the Mayan tree of life is such an essential part of their religion. You see it displayed in many different ways as a cross. It was such an important symbol of authority that all Mayan kings wanted to use it. It was actually created by the resurrection of this maize god. So it's a way of bridging.
It's also interesting to note that the way that the headband twins resurrects the maize god is, in some cases, like on some of the artwork show, different types of hand and wrist grasping, which is really interesting when you compare it with the anastasis in iconography, Christ descended into this Hades level purgatory. Different types of hand and wrist grasping all throughout Christendom. So I thought mm-hmm. that's interesting. Has there been any more found as by way of Reformed Egyptian samples besides the cylinder seal that was found in Mexico and some of the Mayan, when they do their rituals, they scratch in the sand some symbols that match up with the Anton transcript? And I know that in the old world, there's all kinds of evidence for Reformed Egyptian as a candidate with the demotic writing and cylinder seals that have been found where the Jewish used a demotic script to write their old Hebrew. Is there any more evidence in that way, in that area?
No. Well, as far as the actual Egyptian, of course, we have the hieroglyphics. There's hieratic, and there's demotic, and there's meroitic, which are Egyptian scripts. The Reformed Egyptian of the Book of Mormon would be something different because it was developed, you know, separately here, but you could find some similarities. I don't know of anything definite. I do actually have in the chapter in our new book on Chichen Itza, I do have a photo provided to me by another LDS author of some stones that were in exhibit at a nearby town that have carvings on them, which look very similar to some of the characters in the manuscript. And so I have photos of that, and also where I've gone and accentuated so you can see what they actually are. And so beyond that, which is just, you know, there's not much more I can say. I don't know of much more. I kind of have the idea that, you know, Nephite records would be extremely rare and would either be very well hidden up or would have been destroyed by the Spanish.
Mostly probably was a priestly writing system that was developed by the prophets and the priests. And it's interesting that on, like, the replica of the Tico calendar stone, you might want to take a look at that, on the garbs and the sashes of the priest or whatever these people represented are some characters that match up with the Anthon transcript, I think is kind of interesting.
Which stone was that?
What's that?
Excuse me, which stone was that?
The Tikal calendar stone.
Okay. Yeah, there's a whole lot out there that, I mean, I've looked into stuff that deals specifically with the sites that I've visited or you know, somewhat similar. But yeah, there's just so much out there that I still, you know, need to find out. So one thing that's great is the Book of Mormon Archaeological Forum is a great place to see all, you know, kinds of scholarship in many different areas. And they're... they have a yearly conference held in Salt Lake City in the fall, and the next one's coming up this October. I'll actually be speaking at it, and my topic is horses in ancient America. So they're a great place to go to find, you know, the most, I guess, serious LDS scholars that are writing and talking about this and seeing what they're saying. They don't all agree on everything. But these are guys that are very smart, and so it's certainly worth looking at.
One last question, if I may.
Sure.
Concerning the types of grains that have been found, I know the corn is mentioned in the Book of Mormon. That's a very common thing to see in the artifacts. Here's an interesting source from the Timeless Vision of Teotihuacan. Echelene and the sacred mountain beyond the Pyramid of Sun claimed a place in the ancient cosmos of Central America. It shows a picture of corn, cotton, squash, and flowers. Now, is that another area that is being looked into? And I think that all these things, like they found horses and wheels and you know, the little ceramics that show the toy with wheels on them, of course, probably aren't going to convince the critics, but they're just kind of like the icing on the cake for people that already have a testimony for the Book of Mormon, and I think Van would agree with this, right, Van?
Well, I can't just say yes or no after what you said so far. Let's just go ahead.
It's a personal thing.
It's true that those don't convince the critics, but you know, for those of us who do already have a belief, they certainly are, you know, interesting.
Yeah, my real interest on the Book of Mormon is that we go back to the 19th century in 1830. The Book of Mormon was published, and it was published for a certain reason, and that's really where my primary focus is, not about ancient history, and so that's really, you know, where I'm looking, is because it was, the Book of Mormon was published for a certain purpose, and it's been remarkable. It's just amazing that Joseph Smith published the book and published 5,000 copies. I mean, they didn't do that back then. They published a book. It was 100 or 200 copies. And Joseph Smith didn't have any money, didn't have any means to do it. To me, I look at the what happened with the Book of Mormon and the Restoration and what Joseph Smith has laid out, what's happened. It's today the church is based upon what Joseph Smith had set up, and what was Joseph Smith planning to do, and what is the church responding to what Joseph Smith was doing. And to me, I'm just really impressed. I'm more impressed than that than if I found out about some corn somewhere. Of course, they had corn here anyway. But
I understand. I've heard your position over the years, and I respect that ban. I actually thought of one other question, and that is concerning the dark and light skins mentioned in the Book of Mormon. I kind of wonder if that's symbolic rather than literal, especially after studying early to later Christian garment symbolism, where if you're clothed in black, it's not a good thing, and if you're clothed, your skins, garments were made out of animal skins. If they are spotted to the point of blackness, that's not a good thing in front of God's judgment. Or if they are washed white, that's actually a good thing. And that seems to be one of the themes that's in the Book of Mormon, is that an area of research that NAB have done, it favors very favorably with early to later Christian symbolism of garment washings and anointings and things like that.
Well, I think there's definitely a symbolic aspect to it, but also there are representations among the Maya of people of different skin color. And I don't think that's been fully explained by traditional archaeology. I've seen the paintings myself where whoever was painting that initially was really trying to say, hey, here are two people either meeting up or interacting or fighting, and they look different. So I think that's something to consider as well.
Sure.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to another caller. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call. I had a kind of a question or suggestion. There in 1 Nephi 8, where Lehi has his vision, and that building, and I brought this first brought this up back in 2002, but the description of this building that he describes, that there's across the water there in 1 Nephi 8, it goes on to 1 Nephi 11 through there, that vision, and I'm not a Book of Mormon expert, but a lot of Mormons will know what I'm talking about. The description of that building bears an uncanny resemblance to the World Trade Center right down to the collapse of the building. It even describes in this vision a concourse underneath the building, the concourse that the people were taking to the building in this vision, and the World Trade Center had a concourse underneath it. And I just want to know if anybody had a comment about that. It's just uncanny. All the descriptions that it gave sounded like the World Trade Center.
I certainly have not heard that description. I know, of course, the Book of Mormon itself gives an explanation for what the building symbolizes, the pride of the world. And of course, that could be many things.
Exactly, the World Trade Center.
That's a possibility. I do know that Hugh Nibley says that it's a very apt description of ancient buildings, which would have been lit in their higher levels, but not in their lower levels, and would have appeared to kind of float or have no foundation. I don't have any opinion about the World Trade Center and the connection. I can say I haven't heard that connection before.
It describes it as going way up into the air. I forget the exact words it used, but it said it went way up into the air. It set across the river, and it had a concourse underneath it, and it fell. So I just would want to suggest possibly someone researching that. But that it's always been interesting to me.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing. There are many things in the Book of Mormon that are yet to look into, and there may be meanings we haven't found yet.
But then Nephi is fearful because Lemuel, I forget what the other brother's name was, had not partaken of the fruit of life, or fruit of, which is what the reason I brought this up. You talked about the Mayans describing the twin brothers and the tree of life. the two sons of Nephi had or Lehi, you know, it's Nephi had refused to, or maybe it's Lehi. Anyway, had
to refuse, his brothers Laman and Lemuel.
Okay, but they had refused to take of the tree of life, and they were afraid that they were going to die in this building as a result of refusing to partake of the tree of life. And I thought that maybe was one of those references to reincarnation, because why would Lehi be afraid that his sons were going to die in this building if reincarnation was false? But anyone can look at that for themselves. It's 1 Nephi 8, and it goes on to 1 Nephi 11 there with all these descriptions. So that's all I had.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Well, I, of course, what we are going to see another 1,000 years from now, there are going to be a lot of interpretations and ideas and everything about the Book of Mormon, I'm sure, because look at what we've done for the last 2,000 years in regards to the Book of Revelation and the New Testament. There are so many different ideas and concepts and everything that we've seen people who have come up with an approach, and I'm certainly we already have a number of people who are doing that in regards to the Book of Mormon, but I think it's kind of hard to come up with a with an idea and then just have people come together and say, oh yes, all of a sudden we know what the Book of Mormon was about. I don't think that's going to happen.
But. Yeah, I mean, there are some things it's definitely for, and there are some things that it's up to interpretation. The important thing is that it was written for us today to help us out with the issues we face today.
Yes.
The Nephites didn't have it. Mormon saw our day and said, you know, here's what you need, here's what will be helpful. And that can be helpful to different people in different ways, I think.
Yeah, I think that's, to me, that's a very important point. And I don't know, so many people have talked about this and who have argued about it and everything like that. It's for those who are thinking, well, the important thing about the Book of Mormon is it's an ancient historical document, and but we're not really, that's really not what it was all about. And I don't know, I'm just, this popped into my mind, Madagascar. I don't know anything about Madagascar. There's probably, that was a movie a little while back that my grandkids loved that.
My kids love it too.
But I'm thinking about this. I just don't know anything about that at all. I don't know anything. But I'm assuming that there's probably a history, you know, there's probably a historical treatment of this or something, some documents that survive somewhere, I don't know. But let's say that if there is something like that, then why wouldn't we be at least as interested in that as we are in the Book of Mormon if we're just thinking about history? You know?
Yeah, I mean, if you're thinking about ancient history, there are so many ancient documents that are around that you know, people dedicate their lives to, and you'd have to know the culture and know all that. I mean, you could spend your whole life studying these things and find some interesting things, I'm sure. The difference, of course, is the Book of Mormon was written, you know, put together by a prophet and has what God would like us to know today, whereas, you know, many ancient documents might only pertain to the ancient people then. The Book of Mormon was written for us. I think we can, in our own day and age, find so much help in it and so many answers in it.
Well,
I think it was one difference.
Mm-hmm. When I think about the Book of Mormon, it's this is just as I would just say this is a guess, you know, or just an idea, but nonetheless, I have always thought that if we had not had the Book of Mormon, we would not have had the church that was established by Joseph Smith, and it wouldn't be here today. I think the Book of Mormon is absolutely critical in our faith.
Yeah, it's no coincidence that it was published in the same year the church was organized.
Yes.
I think the two had to happen together.
Yep.
It was the preparatory step to restoring all these things.
And so, we've got something else that's been interesting to me over the years, and that is we have this interest in the Book of Mormon, and we're using the Book of Mormon in our missionary programs and everything, but we have something. I've always enjoyed the Doctrine and Covenants. That's just a terrific book, because this collection of these revelations, and we can actually go back and put those in their historical setting in a different way than we could do with the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Book of Mormon, the Pearl of Great Price. That's different. But what is interesting to me is that I've never, for example, when I was younger, I never used the Doctrine and Covenants for anything. I never used it. And yet you go to the Doctrine and Covenants, and we can go back, or we go to revelations in there that about people that are mentioned, and the fact that they're in Hiram or in Kirtland or out in Independence, and we can just point this out, and we can bring forward some terrific sources to say this Joseph Smith was there, and this happened at that event, that this event happened there, and so forth. But it doesn't convince anybody that the Book of Mormon, or that the Doctrine and Covenants, is a revelation from God. But there are people who are saying, well, we need to do that to the Book of Mormon. We've got to be able to prove that it came from God to prove that Joseph Smith was a prophet. But I don't think we're ever going to have any success with that.
I think that's right. We're never going to prove it. And, the authors I talk about, the scholars I talk about, and the people that are really, have, I think, increased our understanding of the Book of Mormon and its place in ancient history, they would say the same thing. These things don't prove it. And anyone who's going to try and prove it is bound to fail. The proof is on a very individual, personal, unique level, and it comes through a spiritual means, not through empirical means. And that is, that is the core of it all. I think, for those who have an interest beyond that, these topics that interest me and that I write about and I speak about are fascinating, and they're on a lot of people's minds. And I think they can, help with our understanding, help with our testimony, help us pull out some truths we couldn't have before. But, these things certainly, they're not the foundation, and the faith comes first. And I think that, I think we should all agree upon that.
Okay, let's take another caller. You're on the air.
Am I on the air?
Yes.
Yeah, I had a question, actually. I had, talking about the Book of Mormon archaeology and stuff, maybe the guest or comment about the, I heard so much about was what's in the Middle East, in the Arabian Peninsula, that I've heard that there's some scholars and stuff that talk about how all that seems to match up what's in the Book of Mormon, like the ancient burial place known as Nahum or Nahum.
Yeah, NHM, that's correct.
And then there's all this other stuff that seemed to match up with the Book of Mormon, like there being place matching Nephi's description of the land bountiful. How solid of evidence do you think that is for the Book of Mormon's authenticity?
I think it's pretty good. I mean, I haven't been to the Middle East. I'd love to, but just have never been able to get there. And so my focus has been on its connection in this world. And so if you look at the entire book of First Nephi, it's all set in that setting. And, of course, Hugh Nibley has written some fascinating works because that was really his area of expertise on that. So, again, all of this, I think, really helps us get a clearer picture of what went on, who Lehi might have been, why he had, you know, controversy with the people of Jerusalem, what was happening at the time, you know, how long it took for him and his family to get to the places and why they went there, where they ended up, and these things give us a clearer picture. And, you know, his consensus, many other scholars, is that, you know, Joseph Smith would have had no idea how to write about, you know, the Arabian Peninsula in 600 B.C. So it's all important to a degree, but and it helps us out, but I don't think it's necessary in order to gain a belief in the Book of Mormon, and it's not necessary in order to really have it be a powerful impact in your life. It just helps you understand these little details a little bit better. I find it fascinating. But again, it's no substitute for what the Book of Mormon was really written for. And it wasn't written to tell us, you know, here's how a group might have escaped Jerusalem and where they would have gone. It's written to tell us, here's how you need to live your life today. But I still find all these topics fascinating, and I love looking at them.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right.
Yeah, it's. I know this is what's... I've just been so interested for so many years on just all kinds of things that if we're talking about the Old Testament or the New Testament or the history of the church and all of the different sources and documents and everything, that I just really like looking into some little thing. But there are a lot of times when there's some kind of a point of some sort. You talk about Joseph Smith, and there are a number of people who have been wrestling about Joseph Smith as to what happened to the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I really enjoy that. I've spent a lot of time looking into this. When did Joseph Smith begin telling people that he had received the priesthood? And that's an issue that some have been wrestling with.
Yeah, that's right.
When I get right down to the end of this, I've looked through it, I've thought through it and everything, and we can't exactly come up with a source that was written at a certain point in time on a record or on a little book or something like that, and then we have that. So then we've got to kind of sort through this as to when did Joseph Smith receive the priesthood. And, you know, it's I enjoy doing that, but when I get through this and everything and I sort it out the best that I can, I just think that was really fun.
Yeah, it's, you know, it can give you a greater understanding of things, and maybe at that time you get a greater appreciation as well.
Yes.
So I like to do the same thing with the Book of Mormon and all these kinds of topics, and, you know, look forward to more.
Yeah, there's just a mountain of material that has been produced in the last 30 years among Latter-day Saints who have just really been interested in all these different kinds of ideas, and they're, you know, they're things that are going on back and forth at BYU, and some people think in one way and someone else thinks in another way, and there are, you know, these things are going on, and I just hope that we continue doing this. I just really enjoy doing this, and I hope we don't get to the point of where somebody says, okay, we've got to lay this out, and this, you have to believe this, this is the way it's, we're going to lay this out and say this is the facts about the Book of Mormon, we're not going to think about it beyond this, or other items in our LDS faith. But so I hope we keep doing looking into things and having different ideas. So I'm anxious to see. I haven't seen your book, and the new book that you're working on. I'm going to be really interested to see what you have to say about the horses.
If I can just plug a couple of things. Again, the new book should be out next month as an e-book. It's an LDS guide to the Yucatan. And a good bit of what goes into a chapter on the caves of Lultun, a place I visited in the Yucatan Peninsula, has to do with horses. And so I'll be speaking about that. I have a lot of good information I'm compiling for it at the Book of Mormon Archaeological Forum's conference. And that will be in Salt Lake City this October 20th. There are some great speakers that will be there. The keynote ones are John Sorensen and John Lund, and they always have really heavy-duty scholars there, and I guess me as well. So, that's always a great place for people that love this type of discussion. And I'm also scheduled to headline a cruise next September. That will be of 2013 to Book of Mormon lands, and that'll be through Cruise Lady. So that could be a great opportunity to, go down to these places and just really talk about these things and just kind of look at it really intensely. So I'm excited to, share all this with people and hear their point of view, and I think there's a lot that we need to talk about.
Also, I really enjoyed on your blog when I was spent some time on there the other day, and all of these photos that you have, it was just really fun just going through those. Why don't you tell our audience about your blog?
Oh, certainly. I have a blog, and it's put up information about the book, about papers I'm writing. I've got things you can download there from all these types of topics free, and a lot of photos from our trips. And that blog is ldsguide.blogspot.com, so you can contact me through there. And one thing about the books is that we have a lot of photos from the sites. And so it's, it's almost like a coffee table book. But we really wanted to get the idea, if you've never been there, some bit of the impression of what it's like to be at these beautiful places. So we have a lot of great photos that I think we chose really to give you as much of the flavor of it as you can just by, looking at a photo. But, great photos of these wonderful places, of the environments, of the people there, and of the structures. So I love it on many levels. I love the culture, I love the food, I love the language, and I love just the history of these places alone. Then if you add the Book of Mormon connection there, trying to look for that, that kind of adds to it. So my blog is a great place to, look at these collections of photos. I've got videos I've put up from these places and download the things that I'm writing and just kind of keep track of what I'm doing. You can contact me, email me through there, and I'm happy to, share this with anyone and comment and answer questions and talk to you.
I've enjoyed having you. We're going to the news right now. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'll talk to you again.
Thank you.
NBC News Radio, I'm Melissa Rayberger. Tropical Storm Isaac has changed course slightly, and it could create more change for GOP convention organizers. NBC's Gabe Gutierrez is in New Orleans with the latest on Isaac's potential target.
Potentially making landfall along the Gulf and striking the city of New Orleans 7 years to the day after Hurricane Katrina came ashore as a Category 3 storm. It was the costliest hurricane in U.S. history, with an estimated $108 billion in damages, and one of the deadliest, killing more than 1,800 people across the region.
Republicans are sensitive to the fallout from Hurricane Katrina and could further shorten their convention schedule from 3 days to 2.5 should Isaac make landfall in New Orleans. Isaac's western track could move any Hurricane Eye away from Tampa. Florida Governor Rick Scott says his state will help others who may get the brunt of Isaac. This is NBC News Radio. What would you guess is the top complaint from air travelers?
It is consistently the chief complaint among travelers passing through TSA checkpoints. Shoes must come off. The TSA has heard the complaints and tried to respond. No longer are senior citizens or kids 12 and under required to take their shoes off. And anyone who signs up for TSA pre-check can keep their coat, their belt, and their shoes on.